Hi, I'm Nathan Ryder, and welcome to the Viber Survivors podcast, where I talk to PhD graduates about their research, their Viber, and life after the PhD. This is episode 17, and today I'm talking to Dr. Stacey Habergham, who finished her PhD at Liverpool John Moores University this year. Stacey's research is in astrophysics, and I talked to her about her research, her Viber, and her new role as an outreach officer and postdoc. Hi Stacey, thanks very much for joining me today.
No problem.
To start us off, can you tell us a bit about your research for your PhD? What was it all about?
Well, my PhD is in astrophysics, so specifically I was looking at supernova explosions. So the explosions of very massive stars that happen at the end of their lifetime when they've run out of fuel. And I was looking at the different galaxies in which these explosions occurred and whether we could tell any differences about the star formation in those galaxies by having a look at these very massive stars.
My knowledge of astrophysics and astronomy is quite limited, and usually it was things that I saw on Star Trek. How do you do things like that?
Basically, there's two types of astrophysics PhDs. There are either theoretical ones or observational ones. So the theoretical ones are all about computer modelling and simulations. And the observational, which is what mine was, is literally taking images of different galaxies. Well, for mine specifically, galaxies which hosted these different supernova explosions. And you can take them in different wavelengths. So light is split into different types of wavelengths, and each of those gives you different information. So we can see the visible light, but you can see if it's red or if it's blue, but you can also look at a particular wavelength of light called H-alpha, which is specifically looking at star formation. It's just the kind of light that gets emitted when these stars are born and they heat up all of the gas that's around them. So by looking at the different types of light, you can try and figure out what's going on in different parts of the galaxy.
I can imagine that there's telescopes in places all over the world and possibly above the world as well.
Yep.
That help with this. How do you get access to this data then for your PhD?
There are telescopes everywhere. The only ones that I used for my PhD were sitting on La Palma, which is one of the Canary Islands. It works the same with all telescopes, basically. You have to apply for time. It's quite a competitive thing, so astronomers throughout the world will write time applications, we call them, and there's a board of astronomers who will sit there and decide which is the best and which groups can actually use the telescope. So I used two different ones on La Palma. One's called the Isaac Newton telescope, which I went out to twice, and is one where you actually have to go and program in everything you want to see and make sure that the telescope's running properly and you stay with it every night. And the other one is called the Liverpool telescope, which it was a little easier for me to get time on because it's owned by John Moores University. So the astronomers within John Moores are guaranteed a certain amount of time. But that one's completely robotic. So you don't actually have to go out to the island and take the observations for that. It's all done using a web interface.
What did you find then?
Basically, I found, so these massive stars that explode, when we say massive, they're kind of between 8 times the mass of the Sun and 150 times the mass of the Sun. And depending on where they sit in that mass range, we see a different kind of explosion. So what I found was that in galaxies that were colliding with each other, we got more of the most massive stars, more of the really massive kind of over 50 times the mass of the Sun. And they were all kind of concentrated towards the centre of the galaxies. Whereas in normal galaxies like the Milky Way, you're getting kind of a fairly flat distribution. The reason that's interesting is because stars generally don't like to form in very high mass. Generally, the clouds that form the stars will break down into smaller and smaller masses. So, for instance, for every star that's about 8 times the mass of the Sun, you might get between 10 and 100 stars like the Sun. So they prefer to form these low-mass ones. Finding this peak of the very massive ones in the centre of disturbed galaxies where they were colliding with each other tells you that there's something different going on in the star formation in those regions than there is normally in galaxies.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, I thought so.
Just to kind of like blow our minds even further, how far away are these stars and galaxies that you're looking at?
Now, so as an astronomer, I say that I'm looking at local galaxies. But what that really means, I'm trying to think of it in light years, but I can't think of it. We use different units for everything. But okay. Within my sample, I have about 400 galaxies. So 400 galaxies in what I'm saying is the local universe. So we're not looking out very far in distance. So they formed about the same time as the Milky Way did. Because the further away we look, the further back in time we're looking.
Yeah.
So all of these galaxies are like the Milky Way. They were born approximately the same time, but there are over 400 of them. And obviously the further back in time you go, the further away you're looking, the numbers just increase ridiculously.
Yeah. So just to, how old is the Milky Way again? This isn't a test, I can't remember.
The Milky Way itself, it depends where you look, because people are still unsure about how galaxies formed in the first place. So our sun, for instance, is about 4.5 billion years old.
Yeah.
But there are some parts of the Milky Way that are about 12 billion years old. So the universe is about approximately 14 billion years old. So.
Wow. Wow, so the distances, they're kind of, they're hard to get your head around, I suppose.
Yeah, that's why we end up using completely different units to measure things in. So, you know, you can't use miles and kilometres and things. You end up using things called megaparsecs and light years, which I can't still convert in my head.
Right. So, given that, I mean, this is really incredible stuff. Given sort of the distances, and when you talk about things like something that 150 times the mass of the sun, and the mass of the sun is a weird concept in some ways, because you just kind of think, well, there's the sun. How did you get into this area?
All the way back to why I did my undergraduate degree in it was really because I was the first in my family to go to university, and the whole concept was a bit strange for me. And I just remember one of my teachers at school just saying, you know, when you get to uni, it's a completely different way of learning things, and you just need to make sure you pick a subject that you really love, because it's going to be hard work, and if you don't have that passion for the subject, it's going to be hard to get through. And I just loved space. I always loved space since I was a little girl. I was the kind of kid that wanted to be an astronaut. And I thought, well, if I love space, why not? Why not just try and apply for astrophysics? And I did, and never turned back, really. I've been doing it ever since.
So having done your undergrad in that area that you loved, what made you, or when did you make the decision, I suppose, I want to do a PhD as well?
Well, actually, when I finished my undergraduate, I went away and did a teaching degree, because I'm very into outreach, doing outreach and kind of spreading the love of astronomy with school children. And it's whilst I was doing that, I had friends who, from my undergraduate course, that had gone on to the PhD straight away. And they came, we met up, and they were saying, you know, well, some of the lecturers are asking why you never applied to do a PhD instead. And I got to thinking about it, and I think the main reason I hadn't applied was because I was scared that I wouldn't get in. So I kind of went, well, what's the worst that could happen? And I applied and got into it, so... I got my background in teaching, so I can carry on doing outreach, I think, to a much better standard. But yeah, it was my lecturers and friends really who encouraged me to apply for the PhD then.
Well, that's really cool. Can we fast forward to around the time when you were finishing your thesis and submitting?
Yep.
So when you'd done that, or I suppose around that time, what did you do to prepare for your viva?
I read my thesis a couple of times, which is always one of the... Well, I think it's definitely beneficial, but it's always quite hard to do because you start reading it and you start thinking, oh, I could have done this so much better. But it's just to kind of remember everything that you put in there. I also looked up the last, I don't know, about 4 years worth of papers that my external examiner had written or had been on, so I could get an understanding of what his research interests were. And then I think some people say they reread every paper that they've cited in the thesis, and I couldn't do that. There were hundreds of them, and I just thought, you know, I need to prioritize my time. So I picked out, you know, the seminal papers, the really famous papers in that area, and just reread all of those to make sure that I definitely understood everything that was going on in them.
Did you annotate your thesis at all?
Yes, I did. And I took that annotated copy into the Viva with me.
Did you have a mock Viva?
I didn't have like an official mock Viva. I did sit down with my supervisor, and in advance he'd gone through my thesis as if he was examining it. So there are certain things that he'd questioned or just wanted me to explain to check that I understood them. So I did do that, which was beneficial in some ways, because it got me thinking a bit more about my thesis. In other ways, it wasn't, because my supervisor, obviously because he's from a slightly different research background than my examiners, the kind of questions that he was coming up with were completely different for the kind of questions that my examiners came up with. So it's not like they picked out the same areas. But it was good just talking through it.
Did you get any advice from anyone before your Viva? Like people in your department or...?
I spoke to quite a lot of the people who'd recently had their own Vivas. And the things that I did to prepare, but like, you know, making sure you'd read through the thesis a few times and the examiner's recent publications and things, they were all tips that I got from other people who'd been through this. But I think the biggest advice that any of them gave me was just to try not get too stressed out. Because I find that's my biggest problem, that if I get too stressed, my brain just shuts down. So it was more tips on how to try and keep calm and everything in there rather than anything else.
Yeah. So as the Viva was coming up, how were you feeling about it then? Were you managing to keep on an even keel?
I think I was. I had started getting worked up the day before, but then I went into university the day before and came across an email, and my examiner was actually flying in from Finland, and he'd been unwell and had to cancel the flight. So the day before, I thought I'd got all prepared for it and everything, and then I came into this email saying basically we're going to have to postpone it for a few days, which was difficult. I think I was probably more stressed because I had to wait an extra 3 days than if it had been when it was supposed to.
Wow, I've never heard of that before.
Yeah.
So your Viva was relatively recently, wasn't it?
Yeah, just in February, beginning of February.
Okay. So what happened then on the day? On the day of the actual Viva?
So I went into university probably an hour before my Viva was supposed to be. And that's another one of the tips that I got from some of the other students, was not to go in too long before. Because you go in with the best intentions of sitting down and, you know, I'll just do this, but actually you just sit there in your suit getting more and more stressed out. So I made an effort to get there just about an hour before. And I consciously didn't look at any of my stuff, because I didn't want to come across something that I then thought, oh gosh, what if I can't understand that? And then got stressed out. So I was, I just waited, I got a cup of tea. Just waited for the examiners to come down and collect me.
So when your Viva started, did you have to do a presentation of any kind? They asked you that?
No, I didn't have to do any presentations. It was basically just the form of, I sat down with the examiners and we all had a copy of my thesis, and they literally flicked through every page of my thesis, and anywhere that they'd come up with questions or anything, then we had a discussion. There were some parts that I might have explained things on the whiteboard, so I might have had to draw something, but I didn't actually have to give a presentation.
Okay. And what did you take with you into your Viva? I think you've mentioned taking like your own annotated copy of your thesis, but did you take anything else with you?
I took the copy of the thesis. I took a pen just to make sure I could write any notes in case they came up with something. It might not have necessarily been something to change on the thesis, but they also said, oh, you know, I'd like to see you maybe investigate this further when you do a postdoc or something. So it was tips that they gave about my research as well. And I took a cup of green tea to try and keep me calm.
I've never heard anyone suggest green tea before. That's great. So what were the questions like?
Generally, I mean, I think this might depend on what your examiners are like, but my examiners were very nice. The questions were all fair. There are some questions in the introduction section especially that you might not be able to answer because you don't know everything about everyone's work that's ever happened in that area. Generally, it might have just been, oh, well, I didn't quite understand what you meant by this bit. Could you just clarify that? Or how did you actually go about doing this? It was most of them were leading questions. It was never a question where if you were stuck, they were just like, right, well, that's it. You failed. You know, it was more if you can't answer it that way, they might try and rephrase it or they might try and say, was it to do with this? And then you're like, oh, yes. And it kind of clicks in your mind then.
Yeah. Was the Viva stressful at all when you were in there?
When I was in there, it was nowhere near as bad as I thought. I don't know if stressful is the word. It was really intense, really intense, just because it's such a long time talking about kind of, you know, high-level research and keeping your mind engaged for all of that time. I think intense is probably the word I would use.
Okay. And how long was your Viva?
So mine was 2.5 hours.
And did it feel like that?
Time-wise, it did feel like it went quicker, but there was a point, which I think was probably after about an hour and 3/4 or 2 hours, where I could feel that my brain was starting to switch off. And it took me a lot longer to try and think of answers and just try and engage it again.
When it got to the end of the Viva, what happened?
Yeah, so we got to the end, my examiners kind of shook my hands and everything, and then I left the room and they sat there for about 10 or 15 minutes and basically made the decision about whether it was a pass, whether it was a pass with minor or major corrections, etc. And then they called me back in and just let me know the result, and that was about it, really.
So what that's brilliant. I love hearing that people, you know, they just waited a little while and then somebody told them to come back in.
Yeah.
it's really great. What sort of corrections did you get? Or did you get corrections, I suppose is better.
Yeah, I got minor corrections.
Yeah.
Most of mine actually were grammatical errors and things like that. It's, you know, the abbreviation of supernova and whether I'd pluralised it or not was the main correction. So I didn't have anything research-wise. It was all fairly small things, thankfully.
That's great. So we'll come back to your to the PhD and the Viva in a moment. So what have you been doing since you had your Viva?
I've started a postdoc at the same institute. I was quite lucky in a way that STFC gives out 1-year postdoc positions to universities, and so STFC is the funding body for science and technology essentially, and it was my university's turn to get this 1-year postdoc funding, which is just for internal students. So I'd applied for that and managed to get that. So that was a 1-year postdoc, which I turned into 2 years because I also, throughout my PhD, did quite a lot of work for a charity called the Ogden Trust, whose aim is just to promote physics within schools. And I approached them, and basically they matched my wage so that I can do 50-50 research and outreach work over the next 2 years. So I started that at the beginning of March.
Okay, and so what kind of things are you doing as part of your outreach?
what I said before about the robotic telescope that we have at the Institute, and part of the time on that telescope is dedicated to school children, and it's just through a website called the National Schools Observatory. And within that website, schools can request different observations, but we put an astronomer between kind of the website and the telescope so that we can try and guide students so they can do different observing programs and they can try and ask scientific questions. So part of my outreach is to develop different observing programs on there. I also go into schools quite a lot and do either different talks or workshops. One of the things that I do in conjunction with the University of Liverpool and their outreach, at physics outreach group, is a Women in Physics Day, just to try and promote more girls to kind of get an interest in physics and see what physics is really like at a higher level when you're researching, and just the day-to-day job of a physicist, really, because there's the lack of women in this particular subject area. So we're trying to kind of get an environment where it's just girls go along and most of the staff helping out are women, and they can just get a bit more relaxed and they feel a bit more free to ask questions.
Yeah, I can see that as being really important. I think there's kind of like a growing awareness about that problem.
Yeah. I think the best outreach workers are the ones that are still engaged in research. Not necessarily having to do it themselves, but keeping up to date on what the new research is. So I feel quite privileged that I've got the role of being able to do both. In the long term, it's probably probably not sustainable to do it the way I'm doing it. I think more because it would wear me out than anything else. And at the moment, I'm not sure which route I'll end up going down.
It's really cool that you have this this opportunity to try both and see where it goes.
Yeah, I think I'm really lucky as well, because my department is, you know, not all academic departments would allow you to do that much research. That much outreach. Unfortunately, you do get some academics who just think outreach shouldn't be a part of their job, even though most of their work is funded by the taxpayer. So it's, I think it's important to put something back in. But my department's been really, really encouraging all the way through. So, I think it's a really great opportunity for the next couple of years.
Yeah. Thanks, Stacey. There's always two questions that I ask right at the end of the podcast, just to try and capture some final thoughts. And the first one is, what advice would you give someone who was starting a PhD?
I think I would say perseverance. During the course of the PhD, you have some fantastic highs and some really low lows, and it's just being able to kind of get through those and understand that you're not the only person who goes through that. So I know the students at my institute, we have a phrase called the second year blues, and it happened for some reason all of us, when it got to the second year, you at some stage within that year, we kind of all went through this phase of just going, oh gosh, I've not done anything, and what am I doing, and you know, is this really what I want, and it happened to all of us. So it wasn't one of those things you think when you're going through it maybe it's just you. But it's just kind of, it's that roller coaster of doing the PhD, but it always gets high again.
I think I'm going to find ways and opportunities to use that phrase, second year blues. That's great.
Yeah.
And it's really true as well.
Yeah.
And my final question then is, what advice would you give someone who was preparing for their viva?
I think try and stay calm. Make sure that you read your thesis, because a lot of people get carried away reading papers that they've cited and things, but the point of the viva is to check that you've done the work in your thesis. So it's more important that you understand everything you put in that, because it takes so long to write that sometimes you can have forgotten things that you've put in. So making sure you've read that, and just trying not to stress yourself out too much. It's never as bad as you think it is.
I think that's a great note to finish on. So thank you very much, Stacey.
Thank you.
That's all for episode 17. Thanks to Stacey for taking part today and to you for listening. If you've got a story to share or you'd like to tell others about your Viva experience, then please get in touch, either through the website, by tweeting at Viva Survivors, or emailing podcast@viva-survivors.com. Until next time, I'm Nathan Ryder, and thanks for listening.